Good morning, church. My name is Ben Banta, and I'm connected here through the men's ministry, and then our family is also connected through a life group. Join me today. We're going to continue going through the book of John. We'll be going through John 5, 1 through 17. It says, "After this, there was a feast of the Jews, and Jesus went up to Jerusalem. Now there is in Jerusalem by the Sheep Gate a pool, in Aramaic called Bethesda, which has five roof colonnades. In these lay a multitude of invalids, blind, lame, and paralyzed. One man was there who had been an invalid for 38 years. When Jesus saw him lying there and knew that he had already been there a long time, he said to him, 'Do you want to be healed?' The sick man answered him, 'Sir, I have no one to put me into the pool when the water is stirred up, and while I am going, another steps down before me.' Jesus said to him, 'Get up, take up your bed, and walk.' And at once the man was healed, and he took up his bed and walked. Now that day was the Sabbath. So the Jews said to the man who had been healed, 'It is the Sabbath, and it is not lawful for you to take up your bed.' But he answered them, 'The man who healed me, that man said to me, take up your bed and walk.' They ask him, 'Who is the man who said to you, take up your bed and walk?' Now the man who had been healed did not know who it was, for Jesus had withdrawn, as there was a crowd in the place. Afterward, Jesus found him in the temple and said to him, 'See, you are well. Sin no more, that nothing worse may happen to you.' The man went away and told the Jews that it was Jesus who had healed him. And this was why the Jews were persecuting Jesus, because he was doing these things on the Sabbath. But Jesus answered them, 'My Father is working until now, and I am working.'"
Thanks, man. Well, we were talking last Tuesday at the discipleship class of how do we know what we know? That there's a variety of systems of belief, of understanding to try to help explain the world around us, to try to explain ourselves. And there's many different camps that people camp out in to try to gain some sort of understanding. I mean, when we think about our culture is a fairly rational one, that we understand the world around us by the scientific method, by trial and error, by using our senses. We are a rational culture. But there also is an aspect to where we are highly individualistic, that, yeah, there's sources of understanding outside of us, but all of it comes down to how do I perceive the world around? Even feelings can be a driver, that what I believe to be true is what is true. Now, that can sound like that's counterintuitive. How do these two systems of understanding work together? It's where one is rational, one is driven by the individual's understanding. But I don't think that that's the only place of inconsistency. I don't think that's the only place where we see things that don't really make sense how they fit together. I mean, for our highly rational culture, for our highly individual culture, we are very superstitious. Writing's on the wall. And what I mean by that is there are so many people who have lucky objects or lucky numbers or lucky colors, some sort of ritual that people will go through or some routine that they do as a way to try to enforce the outcome. That I am doing this, I'm holding this thing, I'm using this number, because in doing so, it's going to make things go better for me. It's going to change the outcome of this. And these aren't necessarily spiritual things all the time, but those are growing as well. The use of crystals is increasing. Astrology is becoming more popular again. And all of this is pointing to some sort of idea that I can control or cope or find comfort from some thing. You ask people and they would say, yeah, it doesn't make sense. It's not rational to do things. You ask people and they're like, yeah, it's something that's external to me, but still this is what I'm holding on to. What we see in our passage today is that Jesus is confronted with a superstition of the day, and he shows his authority and his power over that. Now, we might be sitting there like, yeah, that's great. Jesus is more powerful than superstitions. I'm not a superstitious person, and I don't fit into this category. Well, as we look at a variety of stories that are connected, we actually see that it's a bigger idea that's being presented to us, that Jesus is greater than any limits than we might put on him. Now we get to that as we continue our series through the Gospel of John, as we are now in John chapter 5. And as we do so, we see that we are now at a feast of the Jews. We talked a couple weeks ago that this section, this kind of middle section of the Gospel of John, is structured by these different Jewish feasts that Jesus is at. Now, this is the only one that's not named for us. The rest of them are named. And the reason for that is the teaching that Jesus does at these feasts, or the work that he does, is related to what the purpose of that feast is. Jesus' work here is not related to the feast, so it doesn't need to be named. But it is related to the Sabbath, the day that this is taking place on. That becomes a springboard for the instruction that Jesus gives here. We'll talk about the Sabbath in a little bit. But as we get into the story, we're given quite a lot of detail in the first few verses about where this is taking place. Right by the sheep gate at the Pool of Bethesda, that's got these five roof colonnades. We rarely get so much detail about a particular location. Now, for a while, that was seen as a downfall of this story, because scholars would look at this passage, look at this description, and say, that place doesn't exist. We look around, and there's nothing that fits this criteria. And nowhere near the sheep gate, nowhere did they have something that would have these five porches or roofed colonnades there. This just does not exist. And so what was said is, this book cannot be written by a follower of Jesus, especially not John, someone who would have been around in the first century, because they're describing things that just did not exist at the time. So therefore, it was written much later. So you cannot trust it. Don't believe anything it said. It was a slam dunk argument. Well, anyways, here's a picture of Bethesda. And I actually got an opportunity to go there when I went to Israel in 2018. It's a great place to see. And really just bring this up to point out that whatever scrutiny we put the Bible under, it continues to hold up time and time again. That so often when the Bible speaks of something, it's just after a while that archaeologists catch up and see that what the Bible's been saying is true is actually true. And it's gotten to the point to where New Testament scholar F.F. Bruce said that this section and all of its description is actually proof that we can trust the Bible. Because the reason why we didn't know that this pool existed is that pretty soon after the ministry of Jesus, it was destroyed and built over. That's why we couldn't find it for a while. And so what that tells us is someone knew that this was there. Someone knew what it was like at the time that Jesus was doing his ministry. It points to the fact that it is written by an eyewitness, someone right there with Jesus, not someone later guessing and making things up. What we read in our Bible is what happened. Now, what happens in this story is we're told a little bit more about what this pool was used for. And there was this tradition, this understanding that went with this pool, that it had healing properties. In particular, what we read in the passage and from others' comments is there is this belief that there was an actual fact that the water would stir on occasion, and they couldn't explain why. It wasn't windy at that time. The water would just move in a way that they could not explain. And so this superstition arose that what is happening is an angel of God is showing up and stirring the water. And when that happens, that is when this pool has healing properties. That if you can get to the water first before anyone else, well, that's going to heal you of all of your ailments. And for that reason, we read that all of these invalids are gathered around. They're described as blind, lame, and or paralyzed. These people who had these physical ailments would gather around the pools just waiting for that water to start stirring when no one could explain why. That if they can then get to the water before anyone else, well, that will make them healed. That was the superstition of the day. And we're introduced to a man around this pool who is waiting for that to happen, longing for the day that he might be healed. And we meet him in John 5, verse 5. It said, one man was there who had been an invalid for 38 years. Now, we're introduced to him, but there's still quite a bit that we don't know about him. For one, he's not named. He's not a named person in this story. Second, we don't know fully what his ailment would have been. From the context cues of the story, we could see he's not able to move himself. He needs someone to move him for him, so he's unable to walk. But we don't know what the cause of that is. We also don't know. We're told that he's been an invalid for 38 years. Does that mean he's 38 years old? Or was this an accident that happened 38 years ago? Whatever it is, it shows us a very simple statement, That's a long time. 38 years is a long time to be longing for healing, to not be able to live a normal life, to basically wait for the day that water would stir. That is what his life is looking forward to, just in the hopes of being healed, longing for the day that he might live what society would call a normal life, hoping that this pool can give him that. And that man is met by Jesus in verse 6. It says, when Jesus saw him laying there and knew that he had already been there a long time, he said to him, do you want to be healed? Now, come on, Jesus, you're God. You're supposed to know the content of people's hearts. You can't put two and two together that this guy who can't move, laying right next to a superstitious healing pool, wants to be healed. You can't figure that out yourself? Now, this is one of those tricky Jesus questions, where he's asking a question that seems to have a physical, a really tangible answer to it, but he's always asking for something more than that. I think back to last week with the woman at the well, when he's talking about water, and this woman, I mean, she's at a well, so she goes to, you mean the water here? When Jesus is talking about something more, something that is a greater craving than she has. When Jesus talks to this man, do you want to be healed? His mind is going to go to what he's been suffering from 38 years. And that makes sense that it would go there. But Jesus' question is always more than that. Looking for more than just this physical part. Looking for more than just what he thinks is his greatest need. Do you want to be healed from everything? But again, his mind just goes to his physical need. Verse 7, the sick man answered him, sir, I have no one to put me in the pool when the water is stirred up. And while I'm going, another steps down before me. See, when we talk about superstitions, it's not just that we're looking at people who have something to try to give them comfort or something that they like, something that they believe in that gives them hope. The dangerous side of superstitions is it's easy to believe that the only thing that works is this thing. This man is looking for healing, and he thinks the only possible way that can happen is if he can get down to this water first. Have someone lift him up, the water's stirring, he's shoving people out of the way so he can get there first and be healed. That's the only place that he thinks can make him better. That's the only thing that he thinks will work for him, and it's this superstition. But it's not the only place. God is not limited by what we might believe he has to do. God is not limited by our superstitious beliefs. He's not constrained by those things. And we see that as you pick it up in verse 8. And Jesus said to him, get up, take up your bed and walk. And at once the man was healed and he took up his bed and walked. Jesus doesn't need to wait for the water to be stirred. He doesn't even need the pool. By his word alone, he is able to say to this man who cannot move, to move, who cannot walk, to walk, who is dependent on others, able to lift up his bed and go on his way. By his word alone, he shows his power to heal and to save, his authority over all things. This man had a very narrow way in how he thought God must work. It has to be through this pool. But he leaves this day with a greater understanding of the work of God. Now, we're told that this happened on the Sabbath. And as we continue on the story, we run into a problem with this. Because these Jewish leaders see this man carrying his mat, and they're not excited that he's able to walk, not overjoyed that they just saw proof that God works in their midst. They just see a problem. He's working on the Sabbath. Now, to understand the Sabbath, we go all the way back to the beginning of the Bible, Genesis chapter 1. After God creates all of the heavens and the earth, over 6 days, he rests on the seventh. And that's not because he's tired, that he ran out of God powers, nothing like that. He is perfect. He never is exhausted. But he rests as a way to model for his people what we need. He gives the Sabbath as a gift for us, that we are people who are finite. We run out, and if we just go and go and go and go, we're gonna go right into a wall. So we need times to rest and be refreshed, and God models that for us. But it's not just a time to relax, that it's given as a gift to recognize our dependence on God, That if we are just going and thinking that we're doing everything for ourselves, we can lose sight of the fact that God is the one who provides everything for us. So Sabbath is a time to say, God, I'm not working today. I'm resting from my work, trusting that you will provide for me, trusting that you will be the one to meet the needs that I have. I'm not going to work today because you are a greater need. It's also this time to worship and see God clearly in a way that we might miss if we just continue going about the tasks and chores and calendaring events that we have. Sabbath is given as a gift to grow in relationship with God. Now, the problem was, and there's a variety of reasons that we can share for this, and I think it becomes a little bit understandable, but the problem was is when it was just heard as this prohibition to not work. Don't work on the Sabbath. Honor the Sabbath. Don't break the Sabbath. And after years of losing Jewish identity, this became a key hallmark of this is how we show that we are God's people. We are people who do not break the Sabbath. Well, what does that mean? Well, let's come up with some additional things to try to explain what breaking the Sabbath is and isn't. And so eventually you get like whole books full of things to try to tell you what is work and what's not, what is keeping the Sabbath and what's not. And to the point of, if you're trying to keep all of this stuff, that sure sounds like work to do all this. All right, what am I allowed to do? Well, if you walk this far, you broke the Sabbath. All right, so I need to count my steps to make sure I don't walk too far and keep the Sabbath. I can't lift anything too heavy. That's what they're upset about with him for. You're carrying your mat. That's work. I mean, carrying a bed? That's what work is? They'd even go as detailed as to how far can I throw a rock on the Sabbath? If I throw it this far, we're fine. If it rolls outside of there, did I break it? It went further. No, it landed in the right spot. You're all good. What if it rolls back into the right spot? Broke the Sabbath. Good job, pagan. Like these are literal rules that they came up with to try to show what keeping the Sabbath is. And it completely goes away from the heart of what the Sabbath was for. It was a time to grow in relationship with God, but it became this time of do only the right things. Work hard to make sure you are not working. And so when these Jewish leaders see this man who is healed on this day, they don't rejoice in the fact that God did some incredible work. They only see something bad has happened, something that is not supposed to be happening. And when they find out that Jesus was the one who did this actual work of healing him, well, that starts to become a problem. Verse 16 says this, "And this was why the Jews were persecuting Jesus, because he was doing these things on the Sabbath." This is the first warning light in the Gospel of John. The first indicator to us that the path that Jesus is going down is one that's going to lead to the cross. And it's because these Jewish leaders, when they saw what Jesus was doing, they only had in their mind, that's a problem. Not that God was working in a way that they were longing for. Not that this man is made in the image of God and he's been restored on this day. For them, it's no, anyone associated with God does not work on the Sabbath, so you must not be associated with God. But they miss the idea that God is always working. That's what Jesus instructs them of the next verse, that God is always working, always in the life of his people, always bringing good work for their good and for his glory in that time. But instead, they have a limited understanding of when God does and does not work. We cannot limit God in our understanding of when he does and does not work. We cannot be like cablemen to God to say, here's the window that I'm available. You need to be ready for me at that time. We cannot limit God and his work by giving him a limited window of opportunity of when he is allowed to work. I need this ready by this time. If it's not ready by Wednesday, if you don't answer me by Wednesday, well, we're going to have a problem, God. Similar to the superstition that tries to limit the way that God works, this tries to limit when God works. We see something similar in the passage that came before this. Last week we were in chapter 4, but we didn't get a chance to finish it. We were just looking at the woman at the well, and that was more than enough to go on. But there's a story at the very end of chapter 4 that we just didn't get a chance to touch, and it's another healing of Jesus. It's another sign that he does. And this official, this really important man, rushes up to Jesus, begging him, pleading with him, "Can you heal my son? For he is about to die." But Jesus' response to him is really interesting. This is what it says in John chapter 4, verse 48. It says, "So Jesus said to him, 'Unless you see signs and wonders, you will not believe.'" Now, Jesus is addressing this man who's begging for his son to be healed, but it's quite clear that he's not only answering him. He's not chastising him. I mean, he goes on to do this healing. Again, just by his word alone, doesn't even see the son, he is healed. But he's speaking here to this man, to any who are around him at this time, to any who read these words, "Unless you see signs and wonders, you will not believe." The idea being that God does works that are a gift. They're such a beautiful thing that show his power, show his authority, show his care. But the danger becomes not when we enjoy these things, that we get to see God's presence in them, but when they turn into expectations. "God, unless if you do this work, well, then I can't believe in you. Unless if you show up in this way, well, I'm not going to put my trust in you. God, unless if you demonstrate your worthiness to me, I'm not going to see you as worthy. Unless if God shows up, I will not believe in him." And that's as much of a limit on God as superstition, which says God must work through this way. It's as much of a limit on God as having a window of time that he's allowed to work. "God, I prayed extra for 2-day delivery, so I need you to do that." This way is saying, "God, you must work in this way for me to believe in you." It's trying to capture God in a box, give him parameters for who he must be. "That I cannot believe in you unless if you do this work." But God's not Santa. He's not a genie that exists to grant our wishes. He is the infinite, powerful, holy God for whom all things are owed, not from whom all things are owed to us. He is perfect in all he does. He is powerful and mighty, worthy of all of our lives. Now we said we might be here and not be very superstitious. Maybe we don't fall into the traps that if I do this thing, then that's going to cause this outcome to happen for me. If I go to church on Sunday, that means my week is going to go well. If I read the Bible and pray, then that means things are going to go well for us. Maybe we don't fall into that trap. I think we might fall into the time limit one on occasion, where we give God parameters of when we need him to show up. "God, this is on the horizon. You need to address it before then. That's when you must work." But I think the most dangerous trap, the one that all of us can quite easily fall into, the way that we limit God is through this very same way. If you don't show up, well, you must not be loving. You say you care, you say you're powerful, you say you are in the life of your people, well, then you better do this work. Man, is that a trap that I fall into. And I really ought to know better. But it's so easy when things become difficult, when circumstances are hard, to say, "God, I work for you. I'm a pastor at a church. Why are you allowing me to go through this? God, I point people back to you. I worship you. I spend time growing closer to you. So why are you allowing me to go through this?" It's this expectation that I am owed something when that's never what is promised to us. God is always working, always in the life of his creation. But when we try to say what he must do, we are losing sight of who God is. And that's a correction that's given to us in this passage as well. John 5:17 says, "But Jesus answered, 'My Father is working until now.'" He's been working this whole time. There's never been a time when God is not working. And now, Jesus is saying, "I am working." Not merely in that moment. It's not a snapshot to say Jesus at this time is working, but it's an ongoing statement. What Jesus is saying here is that God has always been working, and God always will be working. And so what that means is that as we read this passage of this man by this pool of Bethesda, when he is asked a question, when he is confronted by the God who is working, that shows us that that same question is asked of every single person who is confronted by this same active God, this God who works, this God who shows up in people's lives. This question asked of this man is one that is essentially asked of every single one of us. Do you want to be healed? Do you want to be made well? It's a question asked of every single one of us. Now, how we answer that question just might show us what we're superstitious of. We said that we might not be superstitious. Maybe we don't hold these objects as things that are going to guarantee outcomes for us or change things, or if I go through this ritual, that's going to make this happen for me. But how we answer, what do we need to be healed of, or what would make our life go well, well, that might show where we are superstitious. And if I just complete this project at work, then things are going to be so much easier for me. You know, that's your object. If you hold on to it tight enough, you can just make things go better for you. If I eat well and exercise, then things are going to go so much easier in my life. Those are good things. We want to take care of our bodies. But there's nothing that we can do to where if we put in a certain effort, a certain belief, hold on to a particular hope, that it guarantees any sort of outcome. That's the thinking of superstition. That if I just pop in the coins, then I know the prize that I'm going to get at the end of it. That's not how this life works. That's the superstition that Jesus shows that he is greater than. Instead, what we see is a picture that God is always working, always will be working, and so we turn to him for all things. Now, that becomes hard in those difficult moments. When we talk about how God is always working in those times when it doesn't look like he is, when we see that God is active and present in the life of his people, but we look around and it seems like we can't find him. How do we understand this idea that God is greater than these other things? And not to put limits on the work of God, but it sure seems like his work is limited. I mean, even in this passage, we're told of all of these invalids around this pool of Bethesda, but one was healed this day. How do we understand the work of God that is unlimited in the times that it feels limited? Well, that's something that we're going to continue to wrestle with throughout our lives. And we need to wrestle with it, not just by ourselves, but we need the people God has put in our lives to point us back to him, to remind us of things that are true and certain. And what we see as true and certain in a passage like this is that God is working, even if we can't see it. He's working out of his good for his glory, even if we can't see it. And it's in those times that we try to guess at what is God up to that we actually run into more problems than not. Instead, the encouragement is given to us here in this passage that when we try to limit God, we run into greater dangers because it misunderstands God and it misses what we need. We misunderstand God and we're meant to know him and be known by him. When we try to limit him, put him in a box, say how he can and cannot work, well, that's not God anymore. That's not the God that we so desperately need. That's one that we're trying to create. But more than that, when we do that, we miss out on what we actually need. We don't need a talisman to make God work. We don't need a window of opportunity. No, in times of struggle and hardship, we have the greatest gift there is, God himself, that we can cling to no matter what. So let's worship God for who he is, not merely for what we think he can do for us. A God who's worthy of worship, even if we are like those people in John 4:48, that we're just looking for a sign. We're just looking for wonders. Instead, we see God is a sign in a world that is so desperately looking for something. That God himself is a wonder to behold, and so he is worthy of worship. He is the God who's there and active and working. Do you want to be healed? It's a question that's asked of this man here. It's a question that's asked of every single one of us, and it goes so much beyond what our initial answer to that might be. Yeah, I have this problem. Yeah, I see this concern. Yeah, I feel like this has been a lack in my life. Jesus' question goes beyond the thing that immediately fills our eyes and goes to everything that we need. And we know that's true. We know we can cling to him in these times. We know that he is a God who is always working, because the answer to that question, the source of our healing, is something that's already been completed. When Jesus goes to the cross, he brings healing for an entire world that's plagued with disease and sin. He brings healing for entire human beings, not just with what we're struggling through, not just with what is immediately coming to our mind of the problems that we might have, but everything that plagues us. That this healing that's offered is something that's completed already. We're not looking for something else to come. We're not waiting for the day that Jesus is finally going to do what it is that we need. He has already done it all when he goes to the cross. And we celebrate that together when we take communion. We do so on the first Sunday of the month. It's the time that we gather together as a church to reflect on what it is that Jesus has done, the healing that he's brought to a world that so desperately needs complete and total healing. And he shows what it was that he was doing when he was at a meal with his disciples. He took the bread that was there at the table and he broke it and said, "This is my body that's given for you." That the source of healing, the life that we have, the hope that we go to is not in some superstition. It's not waiting for some work to come in a set window of time. It's not saying how God must work in a certain way, but he has already done it all. He died this death he did not deserve so that we can have life in him now and forever. He took the cup that was at the table and he said, "This is the new covenant and it's by my blood." We're not looking for something else. We're not waiting for him to finally get around and do this healing. It's already been done. The promise is kept because it was done so at the cross. And so when we take communion, we have an opportunity to look anew and afresh at this desperately needed work of Jesus. But not just say thank you for what he's done. We can never exhaust that. But to look at the God who has done this for us and praise him for who he is. In a minute, we're going to have a chance to pause and do exactly that, to look at what Jesus has accomplished, but also to look at who Jesus is. And as we recognize that, we still see that there are places in our lives where we are not living in the way that he's called us to it. So we want to confess of those things before we take communion together. So in a moment, I'll pray for us, then we'll have that chance to pause. And then after we've done so, we can take communion. We have two stations up in the front and one in the back. I invite you to go there as friends, as family, as people sitting around each other. If you're unable to make it to one of the stations, just let us know and we can bring some of the bring the elements to you where you are seated. But after you've had a chance to take of the elements, I invite you to head back to your seat. And once everyone's had an opportunity, we will continue to worship through song. But I will pray, then we can have that time to pause and reflect. Then we'll take communion together, the cracker, the juice representing the bread and the blood, the new covenant by Jesus' blood. And then after everyone's had a chance, we'll continue to praise him. But first, let me pray for us. Father, you are a merciful God who is constantly working. That we do not gather as a church who looks back on past alone, that looks at words in an ancient book that does not feel relevant, that we get to reminisce about the work that you used to do and just long for those days again. No, what we read in this story is a story of a God who has been, was, and always will be working. The work that you did then is the very type of work that you do now. That we read these words that were written in the past as alive and active and life-giving today. You are a God who's there, accessible, with us in all of life. As we take communion together, let us reflect on who you are, and let us be people who live in light of that. So it's to you and you alone we pray.